Thank you so much. First of all, let me just say my name is Mary. I am a recovering adult child of an alcoholic and from a dysfunctional family. And first of all, I want to express my gratitude for this opportunity to speak at this event. There has been so much happening in my life in the last week, and I really truly believe that my higher power help to orchestrate all of this. So before I get into my share, let me just pause for a minute and pray. Higher power, Father God, I thank you for this opportunity. And I ask that the words of my mouth and the meditation of my heart will be acceptable in your sight. Let this share be one that brings hope, brings life, speaks life into someone, and I'll leave the outcome in your hands because I trust you today. I ask it all in your name. Amen. Thank you for allowing me to do that. So again, my name is Mary. I am an adult child of an alcoholic and from a dysfunctional family. And I'm telling you, the dysfunction is playing itself out in living color in real time these last few days. So let me take a minute to qualify and earn my seat here. But you'll never know how much this opportunity means to me, especially at this time in my life. And I'll address that later so you can fill in the blanks. But I was born in Bessemer, Alabama. And you may say, where the is Bessemer, Alabama? Well, it is southwest of Birmingham. And actually, I'm in Birmingham right now. So I'm not in California, but in Birmingham, Alabama. And my story began, I am the fifth child out of six children. I'm next to the youngest, or I was next to the youngest. My father was the alcoholic in the family, and my mother was codependent. So I was, my father, who was the alcoholic, was raised by his aunt. I never, ever got the full understanding of how any of that happened, and that whole history from his side has been lost. But I do know one thing, and that was that his father disowned him. And my father, when he would get drunk, had the habit of telling us, "You're mine and I love you." And I don't know why he would wait until he got drunk to tell us that. But when he would get drunk, that's what he would say, "You're mine and I love you." And I came to understand that that was because he was disowned by his own father, and he wanted us to know that we were loved. Now, he never hugged us. He never patted us on the back when we did a good job at school. He never did any of those other things to show his love. But when he would get drunk, he would, without fail, share that phrase with us. And so these two people come together, my mother and my father. My mother was orphaned at age 12. Her mother died giving childbirth. And these two people, these two broken people, come together and make a family. Can you imagine? No skills whatsoever in a healthy family dynamic. None. But they come together and they create a family of six children. And so when the big book tells us that we couldn't have turned out any other way, all I can say is amen to that, because dealing with what they had to deal with, this is what we ended up with. So let me turn the page, and I apologize for having to write all of this down, but I didn't want to leave out anything. So they start this family, and you know, I can actually visualize them. The big book talks about this person on this platform looking down at this long line of people And as they're looking down, they're passing this baggage, this package from one to the next, and at the front of the line being my parents. And what do? They pass the package on to me. And unfortunately, I passed it on to my kids. So I have to make amends to them for some things that I have done. But anyway, I'll get back to that. So my mother and made a decision to send my brother, Floyd, whose house I'm in right now, to Tennessee to live with my father's half sister. And then she sent me to Chicago to live with an aunt at 3 years old. So from the time I was 3 years old to six, I lived with my Aunt Faye in the Kenwood area of Chicago. And that imprinted me in a way that I still feel today. When I talk about it, there's a hurt and a brokenness and a abandonment that is still difficult for me to express. It's a dark side. So there were three boys and three girls. And again, the oldest son, my brother Floyd, went to Tennessee, and the youngest girl, me, went to Chicago. So let me just say to the DJ, I want to thank you for playing those songs. And I'm from Roseland area of Chicago also, 98th and Drexel. So it's good to feel family in the house. Okay. So what am I trying to say? My being here is a good thing, even though it means that I am the last man standing. Out of six children, I lost my last brother on Tuesday, November 5th. And that is why I am in Birmingham, Alabama, to help make arrangements to have him his burial. So I say that because I've been able, while here, to connect some dots from my past as I speak to my niece and she shares with me some of the trauma, some of the pain that my brother went through as he was separated from the family. And what I found in this program is that, there is racial division, but sometimes in our families, we have issues with color, and I won't say race, but just expectations. Because here's what happened for me. When I was reunited with my family at age six, I was actually, when I lived with my aunt, I was the princess of the house. She had one son. We were the same age. She dressed us up in finery. They had money, so they could do that. So when they snatched me out of that household and sent me back to Alabama, just visualize this. Here's this kid coming from Chicago, Illinois, going to Bessemer, Alabama. I've got these patent leather shoes on. I've got these lacy little socks on and these frilly little dresses. And I get down here and I get tormented by my sister. Who do you think you are? They found you on a doorstep. So what I didn't tell you is that out of the six kids in our family, my mother was very fair. My father had some native blood in him, but we were all different colors. My brother Floyd being the lightest and me being the darkest. And so when I tell you that I was tormented by my sister because of that, here, I've been away for 3 years. I'm reunited with my family. My sister tells me, they found you on a doorstep. I'm looking around at everybody. They have all got freckles. They're light, freckle face. And here I am. And you can't see it now because the mole, I had a big black mole right here from my great grandmother. And I'm looking at these people and I'm thinking, I'm an alien from another planet. I don't belong here. They must have really found me on a doorstep, just like she says. She took those black patent leather shoes and put ants in them. She used to charge the kids money to come and see me. So I was the freak from outer space in my family, in my family of origin. So I just say all that to kind of lay the groundwork for what life was like for me. And so everything was black and white. And because I was born in the 50s, I turned 74 last month. So I grew up in the 50s and 60s. And during that time, people idolized people who were bright, fair skin, long hair, what they call good hair, you know, and those of us who were of a darker shade were looked down upon, not because of any intelligence, not because of any failure on our part, but simply because we were dark skinned, you know, and they used to have little sayings that they would say, but I don't even remember any of them because I don't care to. But what James Brown did for me when he came out, say it loud, I'm black and I'm proud. And I had the biggest afro in the world, and I was black and proud. For that moment, I felt pride. For that moment, it was like we have arrived. You know, this is our time. We seized the day. Finally, people are looking at us differently and seeing us, you know, as people, you know, as part of the human race. You know, it was just a moment in time. But I'm digressing, and I need to kind of bring this back together. So anyway, I came to in the ACA rooms in March of 2014. And when I tell you that I was drugged into the room, I actually was drugged into the meeting. I was already in another 12-step program. I had been to a couple of others where I felt like, well, yeah, I probably could have a seat in this one too. And I've heard somebody say that if you aren't doing 36 steps, you're in denial. So I was drugged to this meeting. What do? They read the laundry list. And I'm sitting there getting pissed off by the minute because I'm hearing my story told in those traits. And when they get, the only one I couldn't identify with was number 8 about excitement. Well, I figured out later, yeah, you have that one too, because of the relationships and the choices that you make. You must get excited. You know, that must be one of your traits too. But anyway, I'm sitting at the meeting pissed off and thinking, oh no, not another 12-step meeting. I don't believe this. And I kept coming back for 6 months, I tell you, every Sunday at 4:30. And I sat in the seat and I cried my eyeballs out. I cried because I knew that I heard people around the table telling my story. But the reason I cried was because they were sharing so much trauma. They were sharing these horrific stories. And I was saying to myself, why do you keep coming back here? You have a choice. You don't have to come and listen to this. And I decided after 6 months, I'd had enough. I've had enough of this. Why? I'm not a masochistic. I don't have to take myself to trauma. And so what I realized later was that, and this is one of the biggest mistakes that we make in some of our meetings, is that there was no recovery. There was no one talking about working the steps. There was no sponsors available at that meeting. All it was an hour of people regurgitating their traumatic past. And who wants that? I need to know that there is hope. I need to know that there's a way out of this misery. I need to know that I can get better, that I can heal. And the healing is in the solution. The healing is in the solution. The solution I learned is to become my own loving parent, to treat myself and others with gentleness, love, humor, and respect. And when I came back to ACA, I made a commitment that regardless of what I heard in the meetings, I was going to stay, because I understood that all of my problems stemmed from being born in an alcoholic household and a dysfunctional family. It was like the genesis. This is where it all started. If it had not been for that, these set of circumstances, I wouldn't be in all those other programs. So I committed myself, or made a promise to myself, that I would stay and work my way through till the end. So 10 years later, I'm still here and I'm still standing, and I'm grateful to a loving higher power that cared enough about me to get me back into these rooms. So, where am I in my writing? Okay. So I learned that I am triggered by emotions. And when I say that ACA is the genesis, all I'm trying to do in all these other 12-step programs is to numb the feelings. I don't want to feel the feelings. I don't want to feel the hurt. I don't want to feel the pain. I don't want to be uncomfortable. So I grab whatever is close to numb down the feelings, whether it is compulsively spending at Amazon or Temu, whether it is overeating, whether it is going gambling at the casino, whether it is acting out sexually, you know, whatever. I just don't want to feel the feelings. And so I will numb them down with something. But there is a solution. And the solution is in the steps, working the steps and putting those principles behind the steps into my life. And so, becoming my own loving parent, I'm so grateful to God. I've been through the step book. I've been through the trait, working through the trait book, but I'm also working through that loving parent guidebook. And that has been a game changer, because now I hear whenever that critical parent wants to rise up in me, or whenever someone is doing something harmful and hateful to me, instead of being that reactor and growing up in Chicago, you had to have a response. When people come at you in a certain way, you have to be able to hold your ground. So I learned early how to have a quick retort. But whatever you gave me, I got it back. I'm going to give it back to you even harder. But now at 74, I'm learning an easier, softer way. I am listening to what you're saying. I'm listening to you, because guess what? We may be even saying the same thing, just in a different way. And if I'm trying to come up with my retort while you're talking, then I'm not listening to you. And so today, I don't want to be that reactor. Today, I want to be an actor. And that means I allow you to say your piece, and you allow me to say what I have to say. I've learned through this ACA program that self-love, for the first time, self-love and self-care. You know, I was raised that you were selfish. Anything with selfishness, you were selfish, you know? So you didn't get your nails done. You didn't get your hair done. You know, if your kids needed whatever, they came first. You know, those are the choices that we make. But I'm learning that I'm worth it. I'm learning that I can take the time out to take care of myself. I'm no good to you if I'm all broken down. So I'm learning to step away from things and take care of myself, even if that just means going out the door and going for a walk for 15 minutes. I'm doing those things to take care of myself. And I'm saying affirmations for the first time in my life. I'm looking at myself, doing a little mirror work. I am smart. I am worthy. I deserve to be happy. I believe in myself. I'm beautiful, not only on the inside, but outside. I'm going to tell you, 2020, when the stuff hit the fan in 2020 and everybody was losing their mind because of the pandemic, I made some lifestyle changes. I made a decision that I was going to be my authentic self. And that's what I'm trying to present to you today. And what I decided, I don't need to put any perm in my hair. My nappy hair is just fine. Okay? I don't need to color it. The gray looks great. I'm 74. Who am I trying to fool? I just want to show up authentically as who I am and bring my best self forward. So let me see what else I wanted to share. 45 minutes is a long time. Okay, one more affirmation I have. I like myself just the way I am today. You know, like Popeye used to say, I am what I am. This is what you get. What you see is what you get. So I want to address the topics that were given, and it was about societal and family dysfunction. So let me share with you four instances that I came up with. One, I already shared that I was told by my sister that I was found on a doorstep because they didn't look like me. And so I was that alien. So as far as I'm concerned, society had we've already said it, white is right, you know, and how did that song go? I'm sorry, I'm going to have to step back, black girl, you don't shine, I'll get somebody kick you behind. Some we used to sing, just crazy little ditties like that. It was really crazy and inappropriate and silly. But these are the things that we grew up with. And if you ever get a chance, there is a study that they did, I think it may have been in the 60s, where they had a white doll and a black doll. And they asked these school children to talk about these two dolls. And for some reason, the black children did not like the black doll. The black doll was ugly. The black doll was stupid. It wasn't even a talking doll. It was just the perception that these children had been fed and they were projecting it onto these dolls. So that was what I was fed at a very young age, that because I was darker than everybody else in my family, you know, something was wrong with me, that I was defected in some way. And when I went to school, I carried all of that baggage and garbage with me. So when I graduated from, and this is the second incident, when I graduated from elementary school, and I'm dating myself with this one, my father gave me money to go and buy a transistor radio. Transistor radios, anybody remember what those things? Okay, so what I didn't know and what nobody told me, I was living in Chicago, but I was living in the projects at the time, the Robert Taylor homes, and they're close to the ball field, Comiskey Park. But what I didn't know was that little black children shouldn't walk through Bridgeport. Nobody told me. Now, my father had given me enough money to take the bus, but it was only like maybe a mile. I'm 12, 13 years old. I can walk a mile. So my friend and I decided that we would walk home. We walked past this soda fountain, and there's a group of white boys, Irish boys, standing outside. And they spit and pummeled us with whatever they could get out of their mouths. And the words that came out of their mouths was just as bad as what they spit on us. And that was my first actual experience with knowing that there were certain places that I was not welcome or that I should not be in. Now, it's just a railroad track dividing the projects from Comiskey Park and Bridgeport. But because I'm from the wrong side of the tracks, this was the way that we were treated. That left an impression on me as well. And then when I got to high school, I noticed that all of the cheerleaders were light with long ponytails and nice braids of hair. There was not one brown face in the whole group. And that was because the high school, by this time, we had moved out of the projects and we had moved to the South Side, 95th. And I went to Harlan High School for those in Chicago. So yeah. So, at that time in the '60s, 64 to 68, it was an affluent area and they were stereotypical, the prejudices that we inflict upon ourselves. Now we're all black in this community, but because some were fairer than others, they had bought into that lie that they were better. And so that was another experience that I had with a societal racism. And then this is the last one I want to share, which is really, really interesting. I was a missionary for 9 years. I went to Malawi, Africa. And on my first trip, I asked the children, what did they want me to bring back the next year? I knew I was coming back the next year. So I asked them, what do you want us to bring? Well, they needed, flip-flop shoes, whatever, things like that. But this girl said, I want a black doll. We've never seen a black doll. Can you imagine being in Africa and not ever having seen a black doll? So when I got back and told the congregation that, of course, they poured in all kind of funds, and we must have taken about 200 dolls with us on the next trip. But here's the thing that really, really made it indelible in my mind. As I was looking at the girls enjoying the dolls, I was watching their mothers standing behind them. And the look that was on their face, that wistful look, the look of never having had a black doll in their lives, just really stayed with me as well. So, we all know what happens in Africa, the colonialization. And, the same thing even in America, where we get here, the first thing they want to do is assimilate you into the culture, strip you of your culture, convince you that you don't have a past, that you're savages or whatever, and dehumanize you in that way in order to elevate themselves. And that's what it has become. And unfortunately, we're in 2024, and to some extent, we're still dealing with that today. So some of these situations, not the ones that I just mentioned, but the earlier situations with my family, they contributed to my abandonment issues. And those abandonment issues contributed to poor choices, in that laundry list where it talked about the relationships that you form. And, the ones that they're never healthy, and you gravitate toward people. Well, actually, even in my marriage, and I was married for 24 years, and I'll say 8 months, because I refused to make it 25 years, because it was really nothing else to celebrate. There was not going to be that silver wedding anniversary, because things had been dead for quite some time. And the lawyer told me, he said, dead things need to be buried. And so that's what I did. I buried it before we got to 25. But I say that because my daughter went to visit her father right before he died. And when she sent the picture, it was my dad's face. I had married my dad. My children are adult children from an alcoholic and dysfunctional household. So the pattern that was created with my mother and father, I created it with the family that I created. I had married an alcoholic. I was the codependent person, and we just perpetrated that. And even with my daughter married alcoholic. She's pretty codependent. But the good news is that she knows about Al-Anon, and she's in Al-Anon meetings trying to get better and heal herself. So what am I saying? That's the most that any of us can do is pattern the behavior that we want to spread onto our kids. Yeah, I damaged them. Yeah, I made some really poor choices. Yeah, all of those things happened. Yeah, I knew better. I knew better. I could look at my parents' marriage and see that that should not have been the path that I would. But the things that we gravitate to are the things that we're comfortable with. I know that has nothing to do with our subject today. I just thought I would throw that in for free at no charge. But anyway, I'm not going to talk up these last 14 minutes. What I am going to do is I'm going to share with you what I have learned in these 74 years of life, or where I am today. As again, I say that I'm here in Alabama, here to be a support for my family. I thank God for the 12 steps, because that sister that I mentioned earlier, I need to tell this story. The sister that I mentioned earlier, when I got down to my eighth and ninth step and was sharing it with my sponsor, she said, you know, you don't need to tell your sister how much you all never got along, or how much you all were at each other's throats your whole entire life. Both of you all know that. So what are you going to do for your amends? And we decided that I would make a living amends to her, which meant that I would treat her better from that point on going forward than I ever had our entire life. And that's what I did. Little did I know that the next year, my older sister had cancer, and I went to Chicago to be with her. And as I'm with her, I decided to stay until she made her transition. And when she made her transition, my higher power spoke to me and said, you know, the two of them were best friends. There's a void in her life, and you're going to have to be the one to fill that void in her life. So I had to call her every morning. And believe me, our conversations weren't always that great. But the good news is that as soon as I got off the phone with her, I was going to a prayer and meditation meeting. So I was able to throw off all that toxicity, all those negative feelings, all those things that I was feeling. I was able to let them go. But then I didn't know that 2 years later, I would be back in Chicago as she made her transition. So I say that to say that I'm grateful for these steps. I'm grateful that for the order that they come in. I'm grateful for the relief that they give us. The one thing that I regret is that my brother Floyd, the other one who was sent away, he was an alcoholic. All he did was get sober. He never worked those steps. He was never able to get rid of that baggage. And he really took that with him to his death. So now I'm here. I came to see him the week before he passed. And I thank God that I was able to do that, because I wanted him to know that I loved him. And I didn't want him to be alone. And so now I'm here. And I'm pouring out to my nieces. I'm here for them. So let me lighten up the moment just a little bit. And let me say that today I love who I am. Today I can respect the differences in everyone. Today I can be at peace with myself. I can look myself in the mirror and say that I've done the best that I can. Today I can be present. I'm not trying to numb out any emotions with food, with alcohol, with sex, or anything else. I'm just trying to be present. Today, I want to live life to the fullest. I want to find joy. In every dark cloud, there is a silver lining, and I want to be able to find it. And today, because I am reparenting myself, when that critical parent kicks in and tells me that you can't do that because you're not good enough, you're not smart enough, you don't have what it takes to do that, I can tell her to take a back seat because you're no longer driving the bus. I've got a loving parent who now is taking over, and she's the one who's in charge today. So, what I want to leave you with is that there is hope in these rooms. I have found my tribe. I had been looking for a long time. It wasn't with the family of origin, but I found my tribe in these rooms. I found people who love and accept me just the way I am. And I found people who I love and respect and listen to. And I think that's all I got in this notebook. I don't think I have any more to pour out. I'm just grateful again for the opportunity because it has been a heal. It's like a healing balm to be here present with you today. You don't know what your presence means to me. Thank you so much for your attention and attentiveness. And I'm done.